that just like the Lord, so very much like Jesus. So
this is Larry Jones. You are listening to the Grace and Glory Hour of the Dyer Baptist Church with our co-pastors, David M. Atkinson and Dr. Lee Atkinson. We are coming to you from Dyer, Indiana. Our prayer is that you will be strengthened by the word today. Now, here is our pastor.
Turn to Mark chapter 9, please. Mark chapter 9. I'm also curious how many of you here this morning, even if nobody else in the church knows it, today's the time for true confessions, would say, I learned at one point in my life how to play a musical instrument. I'm not saying you play it now, but I'm saying you learned how to take... I knew Brother Paul would be watching. Okay, how many of you learned to play a musical instrument? Let me see your hands. Do you see that? It is most of us. That is a lot. Okay, put your hands down. What the other thing I'm wondering is how many of you were like in you learned your instrument in band or orchestra at school. You were in band. Okay? And how many of you were saying, well, I wasn't in band or orchestra, but I had lessons, you know, on my own at a studio or at my house or something. How many of you had lessons? Okay. Very interesting. I couldn't process all that data. It's up to you. But it's interesting because I did a little bit of both. I did take some music lessons, thanking my parents for that. Now that I'm paying for my kids' lessons, I appreciate more what my parents did for me. But I took some lessons. I also played in band. And when you would talk to other people and find out that they played an instrument, sometimes you would ask the question, oh, well, do you just play in band or do you also take private lessons? You ever heard that question asked before? And I'm not sure exactly what we mean when we say that. Do you take private lessons? Is it like, well, you're kind of slow, so you need somebody special to help you? Or is it that, well, you're not serious about it. You just show up for band. You never practice. You don't have a teacher. Nobody. I don't know what people might be thinking when they ask that, but we ask that question. Are you in band or are you taking private lessons? Private lessons might mean different things to different people, but I had some really good private lesson teachers, and I'm thankful for them, the impact they had on my life, as well as my playing once upon a time. And private lessons are special because you have a connection with that instrument teacher that's different from anybody else. It's not like a classroom teacher because it's usually one-on-one. It's not like a coach because usually music teachers don't scream. It's not like the band director because they have no baton that they can throw at you. It's special. And you talk and you exchange who you are and what you're working on. And there's this, but some things you can learn privately that you can't learn other ways. Some lessons are so important or so sacred, not just in the realm of music, but in life, that we learn them best in a private setting. Some things, it's easier to communicate clearly to a small audience. And sometimes the material is so difficult that a student needs all the attention of that teacher focused on that one student to convey that difficult concept or idea. This morning, we're going to look at some private lessons that Jesus gave in Mark chapter 9. We're going to start right after the account where Jesus cast out the demon from the boy whose father said, Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. Jesus had recently been on the Mount of Transfiguration with three of his disciples, magnificently transformed. When he comes down from the mountain, he finds a lot of people talking to his disciples, and he can just tell something doesn't look quite right. Sure enough, they're having trouble dealing with a demon-possessed boy. Jesus comes and takes care of the situation. We noticed last time that even though the father didn't have perfect faith, he had faith in the perfect one. And remember that whether you are still seeking the Lord for salvation because you're not yet born again, or whether you are a Christian who struggles to trust him in your doubts, it's not that you have to conjure up some kind of ideal, crystal, perfect faith before God's going to bless you. Some people try to say, well, if you have any little doubt, God's not going to answer your prayer. And that's not faithful to the whole record of Scripture. The man said, my faith is weak. Sometimes I have unbelief, but I'm trying to trust you, Jesus. And Jesus said, that's good enough. I'll take it. And he healed the father's boy. If it were just a matter of having perfect faith, my faith is more mature than your faith. My faith is more constant than your faith. Do you see how that would lead to boasting? And we'd get credit for ourselves when it was actually the work of God. So even if your faith is pitiful this morning, God can bless you. I'm so thankful for that. Well, the disciples had failed to cast the demon out of this young man, this boy. And after Jesus did it successfully, the disciples came to talk to him. And you can imagine the look on their faces. You can imagine the throat clearing that went on as they began this conversation in Mark chapter 9, verse 28. Mark 9, verse 28. And when he, that's Jesus, was come into the house, he's no longer out with the multitude, he's in private. When he was come into the house, his disciples asked him privately, why could not we cast him out? And he said unto them, this kind can come forth by nothing, but by prayer and fasting. Now, it seems to me that the reason this lesson was a private lesson instead of a public lesson is because the disciples were a little embarrassed. They'd just blown it publicly. We are followers of Jesus Christ. He is the anointed one, the Messiah. Come to us and we will help you. And I don't know who took their turn first. You know, maybe it was Thaddeus. Maybe it was James the Less. I don't know. Maybe it was Matthew. Tried to cast the demon out of the boy. It didn't work. Okay, let me have a shot at this. Someone else steps up. The scripture doesn't record this, but it had to be something like that. There's nine of them. And you know how guys are. When one man fails at a job, the other men just know that they can handle it. So the next disciple takes up and takes his turn. It doesn't work. So then maybe two of the disciples who are special buddies say, all right, let's tag team. Let's get this together. You get one arm, I'll get the other arm. We're going to make this work. Whatever they did, it didn't work until Jesus got down there. And so they're kind of hanging their heads, I think, a little bit. They're embarrassed, and Jesus is tender with them, and he doesn't rebuke them in front of the multitude. He in the house, deals with them privately, and there was a lesson for them. Understand that it was not out of the realm of reason for the disciples to try to cast the demon out for themselves. If you go back to Mark chapter 6, you'll find that Jesus sent the disciples out two by two. On a journey, like a missionary trip. And they did many miracles. And it specifically says that they cast out many demons. So they've done this before. They're professionals. They got this handled. And suddenly, whoa. We don't have this handled. Jesus, we've done this before. I said it the exact same way I said it before. I put my hand in the same place I put it before. And it's not working. Jesus, what went wrong? And Jesus had a lesson for them in private, and the lesson was this. You were not spiritually prepared for this problem. You have to be walking close to the Lord at all times, because you never know when you will encounter one of this kind. Notice he said there in verse 29, this kind can come forth by nothing but by prayer and fasting. So evidently these disciples in their walk with God, in their relationship with him, had some things right, but they weren't quite as close as they needed to be. And he said, if you'd really been walking close to me, if you had been praying and fasting, if you had had that intimate connection, you would have been able to do this. The problem is in life, we never know when this kind are going to turn up, do we? They sometimes kind of blindside us and come out of nowhere. We were thanking the Lord earlier this morning for the safety that he gave to the Dong family Wednesday night. They were on their way to the church coming south on 41, and a drunk driver pulled out in front of them. Bam! Nothing they could do about it. Airbags went off. They ended up in the emergency room getting checked out. Praise God, they're okay. But we weren't expecting that on your way to church. How many Wednesday nights were just like this last Wednesday night, except that there was the car accident? We don't plan these things. We don't expect them, but they come, don't they? Sometimes it's not a car accident. Maybe it's that remark from your coworker that just makes your blood boil, and before you know it, you've given him several pieces of your mind. Maybe it's that child that is continuing to not do what they're supposed to do in some area of their character development. Maybe it's that bill that you did not see coming. Maybe it's that you lost your job. Maybe you received a medical diagnosis and it just hit you, wham, out of nowhere. Jesus' lesson to the disciples here is, look, you need to be fasting and praying. You need to be walking close to me because you never know when you're going to encounter this kind. And you go about your Christian life casually, you'll be fine for a while. But then you're going to encounter one of this kind. And then you're going to be stuck. Friends, are we walking with our God in such an intimate, close, and alive way that when this kind shows up on our doorstep, we're not embarrassed like the disciples were? We can, by God's grace, take it in stride. We can, by God's grace, overcome the forces of evil because we are walking with him. Let's continue and see the next private lesson that Jesus had for his disciples. Verse 30. They departed thence and passed through Galilee. We're not exactly sure where they started from. They'd been on the Mount of Transfiguration. We're not exactly sure where that was. We believe it's somewhere probably northeast there of the Sea of Galilee, as they had been up at Caesarea Philippi. And now they make their way back down to Galilee, closer to the Sea of Galilee. And he, Jesus, would not or didn't want that any man should know it. So he's traveling under the radar. He's going incognito, if you will. He's passing through town and villages, but he doesn't want a big crowd. He doesn't want everybody to know what's going on. Verse 31 tells us why. For he taught his disciples and said unto them. So notice, this is not teaching the multitudes. Who's he teaching? Just his disciples. They're traveling. They're on their way. They're not making a big scene. They're not healing. They're not doing miracles. He's just traveling with his disciples because he wants to teach them something that wasn't for everybody else. And what did he teach them? The Son of Man is delivered into the hands of men, and they shall kill him. And after that he is killed, he shall rise the third day. Now, Jesus had said this just a couple chapters earlier before Peter made his confession. And here Jesus tells them again, but verse 32 tells us they understood not that saying and were afraid to ask. Jesus is giving them private lessons, one-on-one tutoring, if you will, and they still don't get it. Hello? Anybody in there? It's not connecting. It seems to me that Jesus wanted to give this lesson privately to teach the disciples an important truth that was to encourage them specifically, not necessarily the general populace. Don't you love it when Jesus takes you aside for that? Maybe you're reading his word and this verse. You would swear you've read the Bible before, but it wasn't there like it was today. And that verse jumps off the page to you. And it's like God is speaking to you, an encouragement, a comfort, a direction. Jesus took these disciples and he says, I have something just for you. Because he knew that he soon was going to be killed and they were going to be scattered like sheep. Smite the shepherd and the sheep will scatter. He knew what was going to happen to him and he knew how it would affect them. And he was concerned that their faith wouldn't fail. So he's telling them ahead of time, look, guys, it's going to get worse before it gets better. I'm going to be crucified, but it's going to be okay. I'll rise again the third day. It's a shame they didn't get it. It's interesting. It says they didn't understand and they were afraid to ask. You ever been in a teaching setting and that happened? You explained something and you thought it was clear. And your students, whether it's your own children or grandchildren, whether it's somebody that works for you, whether it's students in an academic setting, they're sitting there and they're nodding their head. And you say, are there any questions? And they don't raise their hand. And you say, do you understand? And they say, yes. You say, are you ready to move on? Uh-huh. And then you ask a question, and they are way out in left field. They have no idea what you've been saying so beautifully for the last 30 minutes. and you feel like such a failure. You got to go back and start over. Jesus explained to them again how he was going to die and be resurrected, and they didn't understand. They just didn't get it. The sad thing is they were afraid to ask him. That's what makes me sad. If I don't connect with somebody when I'm trying to teach, that's going to happen. But if they're unwilling to ask me a question, I wonder, why am I unapproachable? Do I seem like I'm going to get mad at you? Why do you suppose the disciples were afraid to ask Jesus a question about what he said? Now, I'm only supposing, but I have some reasons for believing what I believe. It may be that they did not want to admit their ignorance. That's why I don't ask questions sometimes, right? Why don't you ask for directions? I'm not talking about driving. I'm talking about when you're in Menards. That place is too big. It's huge. Sometimes you got to ask directions three times. You know, it's like you change your watch because it's a different time zone by the time you get to the other department. I think perhaps they didn't ask because they were afraid to admit their ignorance. I think it may be, more seriously, that they had a hint of an idea. They didn't like the sounds of what they did understand, so they didn't want to understand anymore. Because the word death is pretty clear.
Yes.
I don't think we need to hear that lesson again. Let's move on to the one about the kingdom. I like that one, Jesus.
Yes.
And I think it comes down to the fact that they were unwilling to adjust their preconceived notions to the truth that Jesus was teaching them. That ever happened to you? You're reading your Bible, and you begin to think, well, I think it means, wait a second, if it means that, then that would mean, no, God wouldn't ask me to do that. Okay, let's turn to the Psalms and read something encouraging instead of something convicting. You ever been there? I think the disciples were saying, I don't like where this is going. Let's not ask any more questions. Because Jesus was teaching them that he was not about conquering, he was about dying. The lesson to them was, trust God in the dark, because true success does not always look like it. Apparent failure is not final. The disciples had the idea that Jesus had come to throw off the Roman government and to establish a kingdom here on earth right then and there. That's not why he came. He came to die for the sins of all the world. He's going to come back as king later. But they missed that part in between. And Jesus was saying, this is going to look dark for a while. It's going to look like we're losing. But hold on. I'm going to come back. I'm going to live again. And he didn't tell them the rest of the story right then, but he said, it's going to look like we failed, but we haven't failed. And he wanted to teach them privately because they needed that. They needed to hold on to that. And this morning, the Lord may be trying to get a hold of you and give you that lesson. That says, look, sometimes it's going to look like you failed. It's going to look like you're at the end of your rope. It's going to look like a dead end. It's going to look like, what's the use? This didn't work out. And at that moment, Jesus is saying to you, wait a minute. Apparent failure is not final. True success doesn't always look like it. When things don't go the way you always assumed they would, it doesn't mean that everything is lost. Take heart. God has a grander purpose than you can comprehend. Even if he tried to explain it to you. I love that. He tries to explain it to them, and phew, right over their heads, wasn't it? He didn't tell them everything. He just told them a little bit, and they didn't even understand that. It's true in our lives too, isn't it? Circumstances come up. Things don't go the way you plan. Okay? Brother Barris on the front row, years ago, he got shot. And that's why he's blind today. That day did not go the way he had planned. But God can turn apparent failure into success, and God has done wonderful things in Steve's life. In spite of that. But if you're just looking at what I had planned for me in my life, you're going to get very discouraged. But if you can say, well, this is not what I expected, but God must have something big in mind if he's going to make good come out of this. And I started right here on the front row, but I could go down every row, every single row. And I could tell you, if I don't know, the person could tell you how God allowed something in their life that looked like disaster that has turned to wonderful freedom, success, and his glory. Because God's purpose in our lives is not that we be healthy, wealthy, and wise. It's that we become like Jesus. And so if you lose your job and in the process become more like Jesus, it's a good day. If you get sick, like chronically ill, but that allows you to depend on God and know his grace more thoroughly, it's been a good day. Yeah. We don't look at life usually that way. And Jesus is trying to explain it to them. They're a little thick-headed, as are we. Let me encourage you today. If you've lost a loved one, if you're sick, if you're facing financial reversal, if somebody's misunderstood you, understand that what looks like failure doesn't have to be. It's just that God has a purpose bigger than what you can understand. And he's whispering that lesson to you in private this morning. We have to keep going to verse 33. Remember, Jesus has just been talking to them on the trip about the fact that he's going to get killed. And it may be that part of the reason they didn't understand is because they weren't paying real good attention. You ever try to teach people and they're talking? And then when you get finished, they say, now where were we supposed to go? Where I just said when you were talking and not listening. That's where you're supposed to go. You ever want to say that? You're explaining to your kids what you need them to do, you know, for the morning or whatever. And they're not paying attention and you know it. And they say, what? Where? So Jesus was explaining to them his own death. They didn't understand it, but they were afraid to ask questions. And part of the reason is what they were talking about. Verse 33. He came to Capernaum. Now this is a village town there near the Sea of Galilee. Being in the house. So they arrived at the house. Some think it may have been Simon Peter's house, kind of a base there for him. So they've quit their journey. They're in the house now. They're getting settled in. You know, they're unpacking their suitcases, getting their little travel size shampoo and soap out and everything. They're settling into the house. And can you see it? Jesus says, what was it that you disputed among yourselves, by the way? The word disputed is a little bit strong. It's the idea of discussion. And they probably were discussing strongly. But he says, what were you guys talking about on the trip, when I was trying to teach you? Verse 34, but they held their peace. you tell him. I don't tell him. I told him last time. You tell him. I didn't say anything. I was just listening. You started it. They held their peace because, for by the way, they had disputed among themselves who should be the greatest. And he sat down. Understanding that culture, the rabbis, the teachers would sit down to teach. I know our school teachers think that's a great idea. We need nice padded stools in every room. That was their culture. You'd sit down to teach. So when Jesus sat down, I was like, oh, he has something to say. We better listen. Jesus sat down and called the 12 and saith unto them, if any man desire to be first, wow, that's an important word, desire. You want it. You can taste it. You've got to have it. Some people are going to be leaders. Somebody has to be first. That's not the problem. It's desiring to be first. If any man desire to be first, the same shall be last of all and servant of all. And he took a child and set him in the midst of them. And when he had taken him in his arms, he said unto them, whosoever shall receive one of such children in my name receiveth me. And whosoever shall receive me receiveth not me, but him that sent me. They're arguing about who is the greatest. And in 2 millennia of Christian history, we may have learned not to be quite that overt about it. I haven't heard anybody in the lobby saying, I'm the greatest. No, I'm the greatest. I haven't heard that. In gym, maybe a couple times, but not in the lobby. But we do in other, sometimes slightly more subtle ways, strive for the mastery, don't we? We try to jockey a little bit for the upper hand. We want to make sure that our plan gets implemented because our plan is better than your plan. We want to make sure that our purchase idea gets done because our purchase idea is better than your purchase idea. Our song idea is better than your song idea. Our whatever, 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 whatever. And we kind of just jockey and subtly move towards getting in first place. I want to dominate. I want to control. I want to be the one that gets his way. And in some ways, as adults, we're not much different than those three-year-olds who have their little fits and say, I want my way. We strive for the upper hand. It's interesting that I don't know how long they had their conversation, but it was a decent journey that they went on. And I know how conversations on journeys can go and go on. And it strikes me that while they were having the conversation, they weren't embarrassed about it. It seemed very valid to have this discussion, this argument. I mean, you remember, it just shortly ago that Peter, James, and John were on the Mount of Transfiguration, and the other nine were down below. So surely, if anybody's the greatest, it's going to be one of us three, not you nine. Can you imagine the scene? And Peter's saying, well, you know, I got a few words in before, you know, Elijah and Moses disappeared, so that's something. James and John, you know, sons of thunder, I'm sure they weren't very meek in their response. Oh, sit down, Peter. It was just a chapter ago, Jesus called you Satan, so I don't think you're going to be the greatest. And so then some of the nine say, well, okay, maybe you got on the Mount of Transfiguration because God knew you didn't have as much faith as we do. We believe in him anyways. And on it went. And it made sense to them at the time. Doesn't it always make sense? There's a reason why my way is the best way. And if it weren't truly better than theirs, I would gladly yield to them. But for the good of everyone, I have to get my way. And we tell ourselves this. Notice that this argument about who is the greatest made perfect sense until they were in the presence of Jesus. And when Jesus was right there face to face with them and he said, hey, what were you talking about anyways? Suddenly, their argument about who was the greatest was a moot point. There was, doesn't matter. Never mind. Forget it. So when you find yourselves in those mini power struggles, whether it's between husband and wife or parent and child or wherever, when you find yourselves in those mini power struggles, do you know who's not there? Jesus. Because if Jesus were there, never mind, it doesn't matter. Let's not talk about it, right? So Jesus takes them aside to teach them a lesson privately. Because he's trying to mercifully but memorably correct the disciples on a crucial error. If they didn't get this idea of servanthood, it was going to be a short church history. They had to get this. The question then is, why did Jesus bring a child into it? I don't know all the reasons, but I have observed that when you bring a child into a room, it affects the conversation. It changes things, doesn't it? Simple illustration. At our house this weekend, it was beautiful weather outside, wasn't it? No. So we were inside and trying to find something to do, and we did what you ought to do once every decade or two. We pulled out the home videos. I'm talking the VHS home videos. Yes. And we watched video footage of several of our children when they were born. So tender. I was touched. It was a happy time. But as we watched it, don't worry, I'm not going to tell them. It's okay. As we watched it, not only was it touching to look at our babies when they were, But it was interesting to listen to all the adults. Adults around newborn babies are hysterical. Oh, look at her eyes. Like, every baby's eyes are exactly the same. Ooh, look at their fingers. Yeah, you go up and down the hospital ward, they all have a little, just like that. Ooh, good set of lungs on that one. Right? And we say, and then what I love is when we try to get the babies to smile. And we deceive ourselves, you know, we'll tap on their chin or we'll kind of, you know, do this thing. And they'll do this, you know, they're newborns doing an Elvis impression or something, you know, and they are not smiling. They're twitching because you're bugging them. But see, oh, they smiled. They love me. No, they don't. They just wish you'd quit touching them. But. You know, there was video footage of us there in the hospital room, an hour, 30 minutes after the baby's born. It's quiet. There's no ticking clock. Nobody's, you know, checking their email. We're all just sitting there, wow, look at the baby. Look at the, oh, they breathe. And we just... time stands still. And you're just quiet. And suddenly all those things that you were hustling and bustling about, you know, yesterday, don't matter. The child kind of just changes the chemistry of the conversation. And Jesus knew that. And he was dealing with this rough bunch of guys arguing about who's going to be greatest. And I can picture it. He's there. It says in the house. They've arrived. What were you all talking about? They didn't answer because they were ashamed. And it says he sat down. It doesn't say if he sat on the floor or sat on a chair, but he pulled up a chair. Let's just imagine. Come on, I want to talk to you. And he's going to talk to his disciples. And he says, if any man desires to be first, he must be the servant of all. But remember, this is not a church or a chapel or an executive boardroom. This is a house. And so there were apparently some little kids running around, probably that lived there. And so he's talking to them, having this moment. Then he sees this. Just a minute, I'll be right back. It's this child. It just means before they were a teenager. We don't know whether they were 3 or 6. Got this child, and it says he set them in the midst. So I don't know if he sat back down or if he just stood the child there, but he's got this child there, and there's the disciples. And they're like, what is this all about? And what does he say? He looks at them and says, you have to receive this child. And if you receive this child, it's like you receive me. And if you receive me, it's like you receive him that sent me. He's not talking about accomplishments. He's not talking about rank. He's not talking about kingship. He's talking about accepting. He's talking about receiving. He's talking about kindness. And he totally turns their ideas upside down. He says, look, being great in the kingdom is not about status. It's about sweetness. And it says that he took the child up in his arms. Did you catch that? So I don't know, you know, if he's still sitting and he takes him up his arm and puts him on his knee. I don't know if at this point he stands up and it's a little toddler and he can kind of hold him. But, you know, he's like, can't you just imagine Jesus saying, hey, what's your name, buddy? Josiah. Hi, Josiah. How are you? How old are you? Oh, as if he didn't know. Josiah, these are my disciples. Can you say hi to the disciples? Shalom. Shalom. And he looks at him, and I'm just imagining Jesus is looking at little child. And he says, whosoever shall receive one of such children in my name. And as he looked at that child, he knew everything about the child. Because Jesus doesn't just love the children of the world. He loves each child individually. He knew when that child was born, what his name was, what he was going to do, when he was going to skin his knee next, who he was going to marry, how many children he would have, how he would die, and whether he would accept Christ as his Savior or not. He knew all of that. And he's looking at this child and he says, whosoever shall receive a child in my name receiveth me. And whosoever shall receive me, and I think he looked at the disciples, receiveth not me, but him that sent me. You see, being great is not about ranking, but receiving. It's not about establishing yourself. It's about embracing others. Because when you do, you're embracing Jesus and you're embracing the Father. He said that when you receive or embrace this child, you're embracing God. And what greater position could you possibly want than being close enough to give God a hug? But we all want to be first. We all want to rate. We want to have that title on our door or those zeros in our bank account. And Jesus says, no, no, no. Being great is about accepting other people and, in fact, serving them. And so he's using this child as an object lesson, much like he would the towel and the water when he washed their feet as he taught this lesson again. How about us? Are we eager to accept people and to serve people and to embrace people, even if they're children? Because here's what I find. We're glad to serve people who are big and important because we think we'll get something out of it, right? Right? But if you serve a child, there's not much of a kickback there, is there? Oh, well, if I'm nice to this child's going to give me this. This child's going to do that. No, you're just nice to the child to show love. Let's not measure our servanthood by how nice we are to the people with status. Let's measure our servanthood by how nice we are to the people that have nothing to offer us. If you'll do that, Jesus says, that makes you great. That makes you a success. All of these lessons that Jesus taught were about humility, depending on God, submitting to his will, and embracing God by embracing others. Let's ask the Lord to help us get the point of these private lessons and be more like Jesus as we go throughout our week.
Isn't that just like the Lord? So very much like Jesus.
Thank you for joining us today. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is graceglory7@juno.com. graceglory7@juno.com. Pastor David M. Atkinson also has a ministry on Facebook and invites you to connect with him there. Now, until the next time, remember to walk softly with the Lord.